All right, so this afternoon what I'm going to do is start looking at the history of the English Reformation. We've looked at what God did over in Germany through Luther. We looked at how God used Zwingli in Switzerland, and then following that up with Calvin. And but God was not done with Europe. He was going to move into England and start making a change over there as well. And as one historian stated, if the Lutheran Reformation began in a monastic cell, the Anabaptist Reformation in a prayer meeting, and the Calvinistic Reformation at a scholar's desk, then the English Reformation began in the affairs of the state, specifically with the problem of succession to the royal throne. So when we think about the English Reformation, you kind of want to put this in an overview so we kind of grasp and understand. But they really had two reformations, there's two legs of their reformation. The first one was a constitutional one under King Henry VIII, who lived from 1509 to 1547. And then they had one later on, a theological reformation under the Puritans almost a century later. But it's what Henry VIII started that led to the reformation of the Puritans there in the 1600s. Okay, so under King Henry, not a lot changed theologically in England, but during his reign, England rejects the authority of Rome. And so that lays the groundwork for some things to take place in England that kind of paves the way for the Puritans to come in. And in this move, England begins a really slow progress or process of bringing the church out from under the state. So it originally starts under the state, but it will come out from under the state. So how did this happen? Why did England, without really any theological issue, overthrow the authority of the Church of Rome? And it started with a marital problem with King Henry. And so Charles Dickens describes King Henry as the most intolerable ruffian and blot of blood in Greece on the history of England. So Dickens didn't think much about him. But one historian said this: other influences, to be sure, contributed to the break with Rome, but succession to the throne was primarily a constitutional factor in the transformation of the church in England into the Church of England. Well, let's deal with the question. What was time like when King Henry VIII ruled? I think to try to understand some of this, we need to go back to 1066 AD. Anybody remember what happened in 1066 AD? Do you know your English history? Well, that's when the Battle of Hastings took place, when William the Conqueror, a Norman, conquered the Anglo-Saxons there. All right. So he took the English crown with the help of the Pope. And from that moment on, the rights, the privileges, the positions of the church was in the hands of the Pope. So the Pope taxed these English churches, drained a lot of money from England, and sent wealth from England to Italy through those taxes. So the Pope had the habit of selling these offices of the bishop to buy allegiance. And so these pastors really didn't feed the sheep of England, but fleeced them. And as you can imagine, there's a resentment within the church there in England. And so for centuries, the church in England had been moving towards independence from Rome in little subtle different ways. So for example, King Edward III, who reigned in the 1300s, declared the bestowal of the office of bishop was in the hands of the King of England and not the Pope of Rome. So this took place hundreds of years before Henry VIII. But the influence of the Pope remained high until the time of Henry VIII, because even though the Pope could not appoint the bishops based upon this law, he still could ordain and excommunicate. So he had power and influence within England. The archbishop could call the bishops at any time under the command of the Pope. And so whatever they decided under the authority of the Pope was binding over England, since they were all Roman Catholics. Now, when King Richard II comes upon the scene, he passes a law that said there could not be any convocation of the church to pass canons and decrees from Rome without the confirmation of the king. So he takes it a step further than Richard III. So from that time on, not only the bishops had to do what the Pope said, but they had to get permission of the king and do what he said as well. So the English church now, and I'm talking about the church, not the people of God. The people of God were now suffering under the tyranny, not of just the popes, but now the kings of England. And in 1215, a council of the Roman church called the Fourth Lateran Council made this statement: all heretics should be delivered over to the civil magistrate to be burned. And so this one declaration was the foundation of all of Rome, one called anti-Christian tyranny. So this resulted in a sea of blood, Christian blood, for many centuries. Richard II when he was deposed, after him follows Henry the Fourth, and Henry the Fourth usurps the throne, and he passes the next law that comes upon the scene. He says, if any persons were suspected of heresy, the ordinary, talking about the police, might depose them until they were canonically pure or recanted. If they were convicted, the bishop could imprison or fine them at their discretion. So that was the law in England. So just think about what I'm saying when I say that. The King of England totally violated the rights and the liberties of his citizens by removing them from under his protection and left them under the mercy of the bishops in these church courts who, with just a very suspicion of heresy, could imprison and put to death church members without trial or jury. So this is what's coming on. This is the kind of things that were going on when Henry VIII comes up. Well, Henry V comes upon the scene. He expands this horrible law, and he hated the followers of Wycliffe. Remember, they were called the Mollards. And he expanded this law by saying the Wycliffeites should forfeit all their land, goods, and chattel to the king. All state officers at their interest in office were sworn to use their best endeavors to discover them and assist in the prosecution and conviction of them. So just think of this one. Anyone who took an oath of office under King Henry V had to swear to kill the followers of John Wycliffe. So it was laws like this that were used to kill countless numbers of Christians. And this was the condition of the church at the time of Henry VIII. So just remember, as you study the book of Acts, as you study the first century, one of the greatest tools that Satan uses against the church of God is an overreaching government authority. So this is why Christians in this land need to be very careful about the kind of men and, you know, the people that they elect to represent them. And right now, you know, what we're seeing, you know, particularly with the liberals, is an overreaching arm that's beginning to step on the rights of the church. Well, this brings us, let's talk about King Henry. King Henry VIII was born in 1491. So now we're coming on up into the, you know, late 1400s and getting into the 1500s. And this is where really we start seeing a move in a move towards Reformation in the Church of England. Now, King Henry VIII was given a great education. He was trained to be a scholar. And as he became king, anyone who was seeking to make him happy, all you had to do was just flatter him about his intellect, right? And so in the first years of his service, he was obedient to the, you know, he was a very obedient servant of Rome. He dedicated his intelligence and skills to defending the Roman, you know, Roman Catholicism. In fact, the Pope gave him the title of Defender of the Faith. Now, by Luther's time, most patriotic Englishmen had a sense of distinctive character of the faith in their fatherland. And it's this sense of English patriotism that makes the break for Rome possible when King Henry VIII makes the break. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of Englishmen, particularly the wealthy ones, that are tired of being abused by the church, being abused by the Catholic Church. And when King Henry steps up to remove England out from under the authority of the Roman Catholic Church, he has a lot of supporters at this time. So there's just a sense of English patriotism. All right, so the schism in the church really comes over a royal problem, not a theological conflict. Henry VIII revolted against the Pope because he desired to marry a woman by the name of Anne Boleyn, which was his mistress. Now, at the time he wanted to marry her, he was currently married. He was married to Catherine of Aragon, who was unable to produce him a son. So she had delivered 5 children, but only one survived, and her name was Mary, and she would become to be known as Bloody Mary. We'll talk about her in a minute. Now, as Catherine grew older, Henry grew more impatient and more troubled because she had not produced him a son. And in 1525, the queen was about 40 years old, and Henry began to figure out, you know, realize he's not going to have a son with her, so he begins to look for ways to annul the marriage. Now, since Catherine was originally married to Henry's brother, Arthur, Henry believed that God had cursed his marriage. Because according to Leviticus, if a man shall take his brother's wife, it is an unclean thing, and they shall be childless, Leviticus 20:21. So the Church of Rome had recognized this curse at the time of Henry's wedding, but Pope Julius II found grounds for granting special permission for that marriage. But with the passing of barren years, Henry wondered if Julius had not overstepped his sacred rights and brought his marriage under a curse. So was Catherine's inability to bear a son evidence of God's curse upon that union? And if so, then why couldn't the Pope just annul the marriage? That was King Henry's reason. So in 1527, Henry asked the Holy Father, who at that time was Clement VII, to revoke the marriage of 18 years as, you know, invalid from the outset. Now, the Pope may have been open to the idea. The problem was Catherine was the aunt of Charles V, who was the Holy Emperor there in Europe. And so at that moment, the Pope could not afford to offend the Emperor, and so he stalled. And as one stated, Henry's personal reasons for desiring the annulment were matched by the Pope's political reasons for refusing the request. So therefore, Henry decided to take matters into his own hand, and what he did is he took Thomas Cranmer's advice, and we heard about that last week from Parker, about Thomas Cranmer. But he took Cranmer's advice, and he said, take the case to the scholars of Europe. And many of the scholars agreed with Henry. So in January 1533, Henry secretly married Anne Boleyn. And how did the Pope respond? Well, the Pope responded by excommunicating Henry. So it's at that point that Henry realized that he needed to overthrow papal authority. So the anti-papacy, these sympathies, or these anti-papal sympathies in England were very, very high at this time. At Cambridge, certain instructors were taken with Luther. Remember, Luther had started his writings several years earlier in the 1517 and on kind of period. So they were taken with Luther's writing. And they would gather at their favorite inn of Whitehorse. It was called Little Germany. So the king calculated that he would face very little opposition from these scholars if he just renounced papal authority. So Luther was having an influence in England while this other stuff was going on. And so everything was right to break away from the Church of Rome. And at this point, King Henry begins to move on several fronts. But let me just mention a couple of them. Number one, he discovered an old 14th century law prohibiting dealings with foreign powers and used it to insist that English clergy stop dealing with the Pope. And so the clergy didn't offer up much resistance to King Henry on this one. Another thing he did was, a year later in 1534, the Act of Supremacy declared the King's Majesty justly and rightly ought to be and shall be reputed the only supreme head in the Church of England. And that was called the Anglican Canon Ecclesia. So it was done. The break with Rome was complete. England now had a national church with the king as its head. And so the head, however, was not a priest. He could appoint, but he could not consecrate the bishops. He could defend, but he could not formulate the faith. So King Henry looked to the Archbishop of Canterbury, the highest office in the Church of England, to serve the purpose of the priesthood and secure the services. To do this, he secured the services of Thomas Cranmer and put him in that post. All right, so when we come to the reforms in England at this point, the sole religious issue at this moment was a reformation of coming out from under the supremacy of the Pope. Henry intended to break, he didn't really intend to break with the faith at all. In other words, he considered himself a guardian of Catholic dogma. And in fact, it's interesting when you go and you study him out, he was actually a pretty good scholar. But in 1521, in answer to Luther's attack upon the seven sacraments, the king had written a defense of the seven sacraments. And in it, he had castigated Luther as a poisonous serpent and the wolf of hell. And so in gratitude, the Pope had bestowed on Henry the title Defender of the Faith, and is still a title carried by the English monarchs to this day. But after the break with Rome, England's orthodoxy really remained intact. In other words, Henry continued to insist upon Catholic doctrine within the realm. And so his goal was to have an English Catholic church instead of a Roman Catholic church. And what he came up with is the Statute of Six Articles in 1539, and those statutes upheld things like clerical celibacy, the private mass, confessions to the priest. So not a lot really changed. You just had a different head. Monks in England were neither popular nor devout. Let me go back. Let me talk about one thing. There were a couple of changes that King Henry did to make this swap over, successful. The two things he did, first was he suppressed the monasteries, and the second was he published the English translation of the Bible and put it in every church. There's two things he did. And don't underestimate, putting the Bible in the English language was really to push just this English nationalism. I mean, don't underestimate that, because that's exactly what got Trump put into office a few years back, right? He really played on America first, and there's a sense of nationalism that really rallied and got him into the office, you know, that back in. And you actually saw it with, I'm drawing a blank on the guy who's over England, but he had a pro-England as well. In Europe, you're seeing a couple of the nationalistic movements that are getting away from that EU kind of mentality. That nationalistic movement is a powerful motivation to cause a change, and that's exactly what Henry VIII did here. So the monks, so let's talk about this. So he suppressed the monasteries. Monks in England were not popular. They really weren't devout either. One author called the foul, unhappy lepers who despoiled poor wives of their tenth egg. They were not really highly regarded. Their lack of dedication to their calling was evident in 1536 when Henry suppressed the smaller monasteries. The king gave the monks the opportunity of either transferring to other houses or enter into secular life, and over half of them chose to go into the secular life. So they weren't really devout anyway. But Henry would use those monastic properties, you know, that represented about a tenth of the wealth in England, to replenish the royal coffers and to gain support from favored barons and gentry who were given, you know, either given those properties or able to purchase those properties. But the monks received a reasonable pension, so there wasn't an outcry from the monks. So there wasn't really any resistance. So Henry's pretty clever in what he's doing to take England out from under the authority of the Roman Catholic Church. Basically bought his way out from under it. He got support. The second thing that he did in the Church of England is Henry ordered the English Bible be installed in the churches. Translations from the Hebrew and Greek were bound to offend Rome, because she, for centuries, based crucial doctrines on questionable translations found in the Latin version. For example, the Latin rendering to do penance is actually in the Greek to repent. So a big difference in those translations. So Rome could you know, really didn't welcome the news of an English Bible being translated from the Greek. This is where Erasmus' Greek New Testament comes in. Remember, he brought out his New Testament translation, brought out his Greek New Testament in 1516. And within the preface of his his Greek New Testament, he urged the translation of the scripture into the common tongues of Europe, new versions. And so because of that, new versions begin to pop up in Germany, in France, and in England. And this fed, once again, national sentiments and Protestant convictions. When we talk about a breakaway from, you know, the papacy, or a breakaway from the Pope, let me just give you a little background there. And in order to understand the background of the significance of what happened there, we need to understand the papacy. The claim of those who believe in the Pope, you know, they believe there's always been a Pope. They believe there's always been an earthly head of the Church, and they believe that the Pope is essential to the unity of the Church. So if you talk to a devout Roman Catholic, that's exactly what they'll tell you. They teach that the papacy can be traced back to the New Testament, but just always remember that you'll never find a universal head of the Church in the New Testament. It's one of the biggest myths ever promoted to justify the existence of an unbiblical office. The best study I think found on this is in Calvin's Institutes in Volume 2. And what he does is he takes a couple hundred pages to tell us what for the first six centuries of the Church did not exist. He begins to explain how this office of the Pope comes about. It's an interesting read there. He said, basically, there never was a time in all the Church over the earth where the Church took a vote to call someone as the head over the Church. That just never happened. The New Testament knows of no such office. The claim that Peter was the first pope, that couldn't be true. If you remember, Peter had a mother-in-law, so what does that mean? He's married. He could have been. All right. Based on what they teach about the popes and the celibacy. Furthermore, whatever Jesus gave to Peter, he gave to all the apostles. And as you study out church history, you're going to see in the first several centuries of church history, you just do not find a pope. The papacy comes through a series of small events and decisions over centuries that gave birth to the papacy. So the early popes look nothing like what they do by the time of the Reformation, when they do come upon the scene. Where, by the time of the Reformation, he's the final authority for the Roman organization. Whenever he speaks ex cathedra, he speaks infallibly. They see themselves as the vicar of Christ. And really, without the Pope, the church would not have an earthly head according to Roman Catholicism. But you don't find that in the early church fathers. You don't find that in any of the early church histories. It took a long time for that office to develop. So why did it develop? You know, why is it that a preacher in Rome over a long period of time became the head of the church? Well, Calvin says this. He says there's three basic reasons. Number one, the prestige of the Roman church from the very beginning. In other words, they had a great history of preachers. Paul preached there, but it developed a prestige and influence in the early church. Number two, it was the capital of the Roman Empire. So when Constantine became a Christian, the head bishop of Rome should have all the luxury of wealth lavished upon him. So here he is the head preacher of the head city in the Roman Empire, and since Constantine gave wealth to the church in Rome, it grew both in economic and religious power. And so when Rome fell, life fell apart for the common European. The only thing that was left standing when Rome fell or Rome was overrun was the Roman Catholic Church. That's what was left standing. So it takes on a role of importance. And then number three, when the churches in the East and South were persecuted, the preachers had to flee their cities, and most of them took asylum in Rome. And so the point here is since these asylums came from all over the world, Rome becomes the central place of authority. Now, even then, it still took many centuries before the office of the Pope took on this universal authority. Now, let me just, one of the things that Calvin points out that I find interesting is a statement from Gregory I, who lived around 600 AD. He was a powerful man. He was a powerful Pope. But I just want you to listen to his response to a bishop over in Constantinople, John of Constantinople. He wanted to become, or he laid claim to the title of universal bishop. All right. So he wanted to be the head of the church. And of course, that made Gregory mad, not because he thought he was the universal head of the church, but just notice what he says. Now, his title is that of the Pope, but see if you think he thought he was the universal head of the church with these statements. He says the whole church falls from its conditions if anyone called universal falls. It is very difficult to bear patiently with one who is our brother and fellow bishop should alone be called bishop, while all others are despised. But in this pride of his, what else it intimated but that the days of the Antichrist are already near? For he is imitating him who, despising the company of angels, attempted to ascend to the pinnacle of greatness. And he's talking about Satan at that point, right? So he goes on to say, none of my predecessors ever desired to use this profane term. For if one patriarch is called universal, it is derogatory to the name of the patriarch in others. But far be it from any Christian mind to wish to arrogate himself with which would be in any degree, however slight, impair the honor of his brethren. To consent to that impious term is nothing else than to lose the faith. What we owe to the preservation of the unity of the faith is one thing. What we owe to the suppression of pride is another. I speak with confidence, for everyone who calls himself or desires to be called universal priest is by his pride a forerunner of Antichrist, because he acts proudly in preferring himself to others. He goes on to say in another writing, I said that he could not have peace with us unless he corrected the presumption of his superstitious and haughty term, which the first apostate invented, talking about Satan again, and to say nothing of the injury of your honor, if one bishop is called universal, the whole church goes into ruin when that universal bishop fails. And so the point here is that Gregory I, who carries the title of Pope, had no idea or any thought of being a universal head over all the church. And so the papacy is a relatively new invention of man. And so it was just accepted over time. And, so the idea, by the time you get to the Reformation time, you get to King Henry, they really had a lot of authority and a lot of stroke in Europe. And so it was a bold step for King Henry to bring England out from under the papacy. So that's the first thing that takes place to really start laying down the grounds of Reformation in the church was to make that break with the Catholic Church. Another thing that brought about Reformation in England in the 1500s, laying down the groundwork, was the translation of Tyndale. Now, I think Aaron is going to do a more detailed study of William Tyndale, but let me just give you a quick overview. he had a zeal to place the English scriptures into the hands of the common man, and that really burned within him to do this, to bring an English translation of the scriptures. And so after receiving his ordination, he once expressed his frank amazement at the ignorance of the clergy. So when a fellow priest resented this observation, Tyndale hotly replied, "If God spares my life, before many years pass, I will make it possible for a boy behind the plow to know more scripture than you do." And that was his desire. Tyndale soon learned, however, that such an undertaking was not going to be welcome in England. And after a study at Oxford and Cambridge, he was forced to flee to the continent to live and labor and print the New Testament. And early in 1526, he began smuggling the first copies of his work back into England from the main continent. Well, in the following years, Tyndale translated portions of the Old Testament and brought out an improved edition of the New Testament. Church officials continued to hound him and chase him around Europe. And in 1536, he finally falls into their hands at the act of a betrayer. But after 17 months in prison, Tyndale goes to his death at the stake, and his dying prayer was, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." And events in England were already moving swiftly to have Tyndale's prayers answered. And during his months of imprisonment, another Cambridge graduate and reformer, Miles Coverdale, had published the first edition of his complete translation of the Bible. And so the edition was basically Tyndale's work, supplemented by some Latin and German versions. Now, a year after Tyndale's death, a Bible called the Matthew Bible appeared, and it was the work of another English reformer by the name of John Rogers, who thought it was wise to send forth his translation without his name attached to it. But the Matthew Bible was virtually, a well-edited compilation of Tyndale and Coverdale's work. And at Thomas Cranmer's request, King Henry VIII authorized that Bible, the one revised by Coverdale and called the Great Bible, be brought into and read throughout the realm within the churches. And so Tyndale's dying prayer was being answered, at least in part. So the sudden access to the scriptures creates a widespread excitement in the land, so much so that Henry issued new regulations limiting the reading of the Bible to wealthy merchants and the aristocrats. But just understand, greater freedom is coming. There's things being worked out behind the scenes that's going to allow the plowboy to have access to the Bible. Now let's talk about the swing to Protestantism, because when King Henry makes his reform, remember, he's just breaking off from the Roman Catholic Church, but basically church still looks a lot like the Roman Catholic Church, just has a new head. Well, after King Henry dies in 1547, his only son, who was 10 years old, Edward VI, followed his father to the throne. Edward's mother was Jane Seymour. Henry had married after he had Anne Boleyn brought up on charges of adultery. But the power of the government under King Edward rested with a group of royal advisors who really had sympathetic views towards the Protestant Reformation. So under King Edward VI, English policies began to shift quickly to the more towards the Protestant direction. And so during Edward's brief years in England, what he did is he had replaced Henry's 6 articles. They were repealed, and priests were now allowed to marry. The old Latin service of worship was replaced by Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer. And in 1553, Cranmer produced the 42 Articles, which defined the faith of the Church of England along more along Protestant lines. Excuse me. Now, this swing to Protestantism under King Edward VI comes to an abrupt halt when he dies, and Mary, the daughter of Catherine, ascended to the throne. And Queen Mary was devoutly Catholic. Mary tried to bring in England back under Rome, and she was very intolerant to the Protestants. And under her reign, she had over 300 Protestants killed. This included Latimer, Ridley, and Cranmer, who were burned at the stake. Later, John Fox collected the reports of these martyrdoms in his Book of Martyrs, 1571, where he organized them. But the English people had to endure many horrors of Catholicism under the reign of Mary. And so he succeeded in giving Mary the name by which we remember her as Bloody Mary. So God finally spares the English people by taking her out in 1558. So her reign was from 1553 to 1558. And after the death of Mary, Anne Boleyn's red-headed and fiery-tempered daughter, you gotta watch the redheads, her name was Elizabeth I, and she reigns from 1558 to 1603. Now, she takes the throne. And so the Anglican Church really assumes a new distinctive character. It didn't really look like what Henry had. It certainly didn't look like what Edward VI or Queen Mary had. When she comes into office, it really never looked Roman or reformed. In her mind, this was a political necessity in order to keep the peace. So Elizabeth I worked hard to maintain a compromise position between the two extremes. For example, the Church of England remained a state church under the control of the monarch, but she changed the title from the Supreme Head to a more modest title like Supreme Governor. So she made these modest changes to try to make it sweeten it up, I guess. But one historian made the note. In accepting the Bible as the final authority and in recognizing only baptism and the Holy Eucharist as Christ-instituted sacraments, Elizabeth's 39 articles that were issued in 1563 were essentially Protestant, but many articles were worded in a way that would satisfy both Catholics and Protestants. The liturgy of the church retained many of the Catholic elements and bishops in apostolic succession to govern the church. In time, English churchmen spoke of this compromise as the best of both worlds, the via media, the middle way between Protestantism and Catholicism. That sounds like a real utopia, doesn't it? All this, everybody's one happy family, but what's the problem? Well, the problem is you've got some of these exiles who have been forced into the continent under Bloody Mary. They're now coming back to England. And they now come back, and these are committed Protestants. And when they return from Europe while Elizabeth is in reign, while they were off away at the on the continent, they had been reading their Bibles. And what they had been praying for and what they desired was true reformation within England. Now, we're going to see these next, Lord willing, the next time, we're going to see these particular reformers in England known as the Puritans. And they have a huge influence and impact on England, and they're going to have a huge impact on America as well. So they're going to become very important during the 1600s. And next week we'll look at the next leg of the English Reformation. So the first leg is not a theological reformation, but it's a break from the Roman rule and control. What we're going to see next is a true theological reformation. It's going to cause some problems in England, but the Lord, through their efforts and their labors, is going to see true reformation take place in England. So it's interesting. God uses the divorce of a wicked king to break away from Rome's control, and then he's going to use this group of committed Christians who had the Word of God as their guide to bring reformation into England. So what do we do with something like this, a study? Why do we even talk about it? Well, number one, prior to the Reformation in England, England was a very dark place, very little light. There's a lot of masses going on, but no light coming from the Catholic Church. And God can use the wicked acts of wicked men to bring about Reformation. This is why we study history. When we study history, we see how God's providence works. And when things look the most grim, when things look the most bleak, this is when he does his greatest work. And so the church needs to look at the events going on today, and we need to be preparing ourselves for the great work of God. Because when God shakes the foundations, all those things that are supported by sand are going to crumble. And in order for the faithful to rebuild upon the rock, we've got to be ready. So that leads us to the next point. Are we preparing for the shaking? So when God collapses all these things that are built upon a foundation of sand, when he collapses all the idols that we have erected in this country, are we ready? When God shakes, if we're ignorant of the rock word of Jesus Christ, then what will happen is when we rebuild, we're just going to rebuild upon another foundation of sand that will come down in another shaking. So this is why we need to understand God's word and what God's word has to say about every area of life. This includes the church, the family, but it includes government, economics, business. There's not one area that the Bible does not talk about. So the Puritans that we're going to talk about next time did this very thing, and they changed the nature of England. So when God shook the foundations of England in the 15th and 16th century, in the 16th and 17th century, when he shakes those foundations, there's a group of committed Christians that are ready to rebuild. All right, so are we prepared? We need to instruct ourselves, we need to live out our principles, and we need to be working to train the next generation to press the claims of Christ. And finally, what we see as we will start looking at these men and women who were committed to Christ, they did not keep their religion a private thing. The Protestants knew the importance of not only believing the truth, but living out the truth and pressing the claims of truth on their fellow countrymen. Now think about what we're dealing with today. The enemies of Christ, right now they're content with us to sit over here as long as we're quiet. keep to ourselves. But that's not how the devoted, that's not how the remnant in England changed that country. We don't allow the enemies of Christ to shut us up. We don't submit to them. We don't have, I mean, they're not our authority. Christ is our authority. Christ is the one who told us to share the gospel, press his claims, to promote his truth in a lost and dying world. And so the modern church doesn't think like this. And so as a result, the modern church doesn't have a real huge impact on culture. No one right now is looking to the church who has been sitting back in the background for all these decades and saying, I wonder if they got any solutions to the problems within our country. Because at one time, the nation did. Well, we need to continue to study out, you know, the example of these men and women who have come before us and see how God changed just not the individual lives, but the whole nature of a country with these truths. And so we need to learn how to apply these, you know, these scriptural biblical truths in our culture as well. So Lord willing, we'll pick up here next time. We'll start looking at the next leg of the Reformation in England. And then what we'll do is we'll dig in a little bit more with some more biographies of some specific individuals that God used during this time period.